You're listening to the Cast Derbys podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley, and joining me on this month's show are Gareth Cavanagh and James McLean. Hi, chaps.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
During Storm Gareth, no less.
During Storm Gareth, we're recording this, yeah. Are you feeling particularly stormy?
I'm feeling very powerful and tremendous as I batter the British Isles with my wind and air and gas and piercing cold rain. Actually, it was bloody horrible today. So I'm kind of thrilled and horrified in equal measure.
Are you being hit by it, James, over in Norwich?
I can suddenly hear water where I am. There is water hitting my window, like in the last 30 seconds.
Okay, that's opportune, isn't it? Here, it's just grey here, but that's like just normal.
It means that rain like freezing bullets is just everyday weather for you in the northeast.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, until sort of the middle of June.
Yeah.
And then for a few days, it gets dead hot. And then by the end of June, it's cold again. So, yeah.
Happy days.
Yep. Par for the course. So we are actually going to talk about Doctor Who, not just the weather. And although, you know, that could have been a Gravitron conversation. Who knows?
I still want my Gravitron. You know, if I'm still, I'll be 98 in 2070. So if we haven't got a Gravitron by then, I will be. Well, it won't be writing to the BBC by then. I'll be composing a thought crystal and sending it across whatever the thought net is by then.
Yeah, but by then, you know, a 70-year-old Lance Parkin will have worked out another potential date for that story, which situates it based on some magazine that has suggested in his own brilliant way, with another set of very, very thorough, overly thorough now, A histories so thorough they're just spilling out into books and books. It's crazy.
Well, indeed. But you know, I always think that out of those sort of Trout and near future, that out of all the near future stories, the Trout ones are probably the most accurate. 2070 for a moon base that control the weather feels about right. You know, 2020 for a colony on Vulcan, not so sure.
Yes, no, because I think Parkin does quite a good job actually situating those and some of the, because I think Seeds of Death is a bit vague to its time.
Yeah.
I think there's a sort of a bit of guesswork there. And yeah, well, at least early in the edition I have, he might have got it even more bang on with evidence in the latest
ones. Of course, let us not forget that a gentleman whose name escapes me at the moment, the hacker that the US wanted to extradite a few years ago, one of the things he supposedly uncovered during his hacking exploits was a secret space program.
Nice.
With spaceships and everything.
Well, you know, I suppose what they got wrong about the future is we're not willing to pay for anything now. You know, what they did, what the only person who saw the future run by accountants was Douglas Adams. No one else saw that coming, that actually we could have all these great dreams, but by the time you've filtered it through the accountants and the treasury, you end up with you know, you start off wanting to build a Lamborghini and you end up with a moped.
Made of Lego.
Yes.
A colleague of mine, David, who actually sometimes listens to this, he always said that the mistake they made with the future is it's not about transportation, it's about being static. That with 3D printing, sort of, you know, you replicate what you want. You don't have to go somewhere to get it. And when you've got that sort of culture, you're not looking to sort of find ways of hover cars or transportation. You're finding ways of accessibly replicating what you need for your own business or your household. So it becomes less about distance. It becomes more about removing distance and convenience. And to be fair, that seems to be quite a reasonable attitude to where things are going.
Do you know, you're right. Maybe this is where we're going. You know, I rarely go to the cinema now. I'm quite happy just to be entertained by Netflix in the house. I rarely buy anything from the shops anymore. It's on eBay or Amazon and it arrives at the house. Quite possibly this is the main thing that Wall-E got right, that we're going to end up fat and useless on a spaceship while the robots do all the work for us.
And it's interesting. the things like the quality as well, especially if we go into sort of fan areas and you think of the model building, the 3D models, which you can 3D print, which again, you're not moving to even locate resources. You're just, apart from obviously having to get resources to 3D print, the detail and everything is far better than things that people that you'd have to pay for to go into shops. It totally changes industries and how things function and IP and all sorts. It's a really interesting debate for another time.
Yes, quite right. So, sorry about this. Yes, yes, we have gone a bit far as well there for a minute.
We have a bit, haven't we? So we were going to... I mean, Gareth observed that there's quite a lot of Eric Sayward-based Doctor Who material set for release this year. And we haven't really talked about Sayward on the podcast with a K in any particular depth at all ever in 370 episodes. So what better way to start episode 371 than to remedy that?
Especially since his era of Cybermen would be very easy to 3D print. So Cybermen themselves could be, you know, I'm surprised that hasn't actually been used in Doctor Who yet. Is that sort of
3D printed Cyberman? Yeah. Yes.
Components don't have to be sourced. They're sort of, they build themselves through 3D printing.
Nice.
No, that is very good. I think actually I've probably been a little bit I've got the figures wrong there. It's 338 this week, not 371. I don't know where I got the other 50 from, but it's not even 50.
Wow! Wow! I like that modest rounding error there.
But regardless, that 3D printing thing, that is really good. I think that's what Doctor Who's missing at the moment, but we're not talking about that.
Plus also, but then if you go to Cybermen before Soward, you could have the three fingers ones, which would be perfect for mouse, because you just have the two fingers and the thumb to help guide, and those two fingers, you know, for left and right. Oh, you've got nothing to spin the wheel.
Well,
you'd have to 3D print a hand for your Cybermen to actually use the mouse.
Oh, you could use,
you
that
be able
little,
to use the mouse because you haven't got your
use 3D the head gun. Use the head gun to roll the mouse.
Yeah, they've got that marvelous sort of swirly beam that seems to do everything.
Yeah. It's always good when you kill your own conversation, isn't it?
It is. Yes, yeah. But yes, to Eric, I feel we've done 8 minutes now and not talked about anything. you know, everyone's turned over and then they're currently watching Buck Rogers now because we've gone all Bidmead in our discussion.
Oh, I see.
If there's a Buck Rogers podcast on at the same time, we're fooped.
Highly political. I can't help it because they've got a bigger budget than we have.
Well, yes, but they're more in tune with what the audience wants.
Yeah, but to cover their bigger budget, part of it is that they've got adverts. Well, we don't.
True, that's true.
And we have a loyal following of one listener.
And a better looking lead actress.
Well, better than Wilma. Nonsense.
Wilma has a very strong following, even today.
Yes, Wilma was quite the thing, you know.
Yeah,
Will. Okay, I feel we're talking about everything but Eric.
It's getting to the point where it's vaguely insulting. We're now talking
Eric
about the show that opposed him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Eric Sayward was editor, script editor of Doctor Who from 82 to 1986. So he oversaw a very visual, violent era of the show, which is how he's often kind of characterised. But there's a lot more going on than just, you know, Earthshock, yeah. Resurrection of the Daleks and Revelation of the Daleks in there. There's a lot more subtle stuff taking place at the same time. And, you know, you could say, well, what about Caves of Androzani? But there's a lot going on within Caves of Androzani itself, beyond the rather violent world the Doctor finds himself in. And I think it's probably violent worlds that's really, not violent stories, it's violent worlds and situations that are maybe the key. I don't know. What do you think?
Do you know, Doctor Who up till then has always existed in a universe of terrors. Always. Right back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. If you look at The Keys of Marinus is six episodes soaked in blood, murder, rape, yep. Genocide. It's all in there, you know, but because it's got two cuddly school teachers as at the time the co-leads, because that's what they are at the time.
Yeah,
and they always manage to go, oh, quickly, Barbara, to the TARDIS. We kind of ignore all the death by acid, crushing, stabbing, strangulation, that all gets brushed over. I think what Eric does is Eric embraces the darkness in a way that possibly hasn't been done to such an extent before. But now I'm changing my mind again, because actually, is he more violent than Bob Holmes and more seeped in darkness than Bob Holmes? I think he probably isn't. I think Eric just tells it as it is and shows it as it is.
But then it's not just about that. I mean, in the same way, I mean, you could say like Jurassic Park is a horror film for kids. All the staple elements of Jurassic Park scream horror film. And yet we sort of treat it as a kid's film because of how it's toned and the sort of personalities which are at the forefront. And I think you're right, you know, with Cage of Androzani, you have a far warmer and positive and in control center protagonists than you do in a lot of Sayward's era. But I think at the same time, that was becoming very part of Bidmead's era and on from there, where I mean, I'm just thinking back to when I was a kid. To me, there was always a sense in Sayward's era that it wasn't that they were necessarily overly violent, but that there was a feeling that of vulnerability, that especially with Davison, through his sort of very vulnerable doctor, and even with Colin Baker, even though he wasn't vulnerable in himself, he was never very much. He was very isolated, very distant from everything, and thus you couldn't feel much warmth. You couldn't get close to the fire with him either. So maybe for his era, it's about the fact that the major characters don't carry that warmth you say you get in Mariners. It's not so much about the depictions of violence, but you've not got the security blanket when you're entering this world of Doctor Who, which as you say, has always been fairly brutal. In every era, I mean, Seeds of Doom obviously is horrendously brutal. For you know, you're looking at that era, you've got most eras. There's a certain brutality which you can find there, but it's a lack of warmth. I think maybe or stability. Maybe it's a lack of stability or certainty within those central protagonists.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think there is a difference between Davison era Sayward and Colin Baker era Sayward. I think with Davison era Sayward, you've got a doctor who is has a very strong moral centre, who is far more consensual and collegiate in terms of how he approaches things with his companions. It is far more back to that Hartnell team, which I think we've discussed before, where the doctor's almost like the sort of like the senior registrar in the hospital with a load of junior doctors around him. There's lots of teaching points and room for mistakes, but everyone comes together and sees it through. I suppose that does change with Case of Androzani. But do you know what? I think a lot of that is down to the direction and the design. Now, you guys have spoken to Graham Harper. I know Graham Harper. Graham has always said that his brief when he took it in to see John Nathan Turner was, he said, I want this to be tough and brutal. I want this to be like Maggie Thatcher's Britain, you know, tough, uncompromising. I don't want lasers. I want bullets. I want it to show that this is a violent, desperate place. That in the same way that, you know, if this is, but then if Peter Moffat is directing this instead of The Twin Dilemma, it's a very different Case of Androzani. I think it is Baker Foyle suits. It's lasers. It's John Savidant playing Shara's Jack. It's a very different show completely. And I think that all of the things that people associate with Eric, that certain violence, the hyper-violence, the coldness, I think pretty much all of that you can trace back to Case of Androzani and Bob Holmes. So really, it's a Bob Holmes era. It's a second Bob Holmes era, this ultra-violent Sayward that we're back to discussing. I don't think it's there before Case of Androzani.
I think you're probably right.
Well, Revelations of the Daleks is very... Not Revelation, Resurrection, sorry. Is prior and carries a lot of those. I know it's an example of an extremely, perhaps hyper-violent for Doctor Who.
But I think, again, that's director-led. I think that's a lot of that is Matthew Robinson interpreting that material. And I think it is, you're right, it's grittier and it's darker and it's meaner than Earthshock. But if Peter Grimwade directs it at the end of season 20, I think it's Earthshot 2.
But I would still say, and I think you've got some very good points there, which I'm not going to totally argue with because I think I agree with a lot of them. But, I mean, even A Case of Androzani under Peter Moffat, to me, still the basic core constituents of it are quite cold. And again, it depends on what you're actually accusing, shall we say, Soured of. And if it is that sort of very hacky hyper-violence issue, you know, the whole acid bath and the like, then I think there is an issue. But I think at that time, and I'm not actually saying I'm not accusing him of this, but I think of that period, you have two doctors which don't cry out stability for the audience. I remember as a kid never trusting Colin Baker's doctor and never feeling I could trust that Peter Davison's doctor would be in control. And that, to me, caused a feeling of tension. That era's tension. But as soon as McCoy comes in, that sort of changes a little bit. There's something different there. And it's especially, obviously, that first season. And certainly with Baker in that last season, which, again, to be fair, Bidmead has a lot of the... It's quite... He's a sort of fair... Some of them, anyway, are fairly dark. Certainly Caves of Andrew... Sorry, Keeper of Traken, as we were talking about the other week, has some quite dark elements to it. You still got that very strong, stable and fairly certain Tom Baker there, who is so dominating that you never really feel that things are totally out of control. In fact, it's one of the episodes where he probably feels a little out of control, which is unusual.
I don't know. I always think season 18 Tom Baker is like the football manager who's done a season too many. He should have gone the year before. He hangs on. He makes some poor decisions in the summer. He kind of loses the press and the fans early on, and what you get is a really sort of mismatch, unhappy season that's always going to end with him going.
Mourinho.
Yeah, it is Mourinho staying a year too long at every club he's ever been at. And then, I think you can swap Tom Baker and Mourinho in season 18 is pretty much there, unhappy, grumpy, dark, doesn't like the material. Really, do you honestly think Keeper of Traken is really dark?
I think there's elements of it. I think taking Trimas is a very dark call, a clever call as well to make. And I think he's in one of the few episodes there where he still has a lot of control, but he's wrong-footed because he seems fairly oblivious to things which the audience is sort of fairly aware of. So again, there's a lack of feeling that he's really in the front seat of that one, which is kind of unusual at that point. I mean, the same way that I like William Hartnell, even when he's fluffing his lines because he's having issues, the product to me for that era is interesting in the same way that I think Tom Baker's last chapter is really interesting because he's so different in it and he's so held back by production and himself. So he doesn't give that performance. And that creates a whole different dynamic. If it had been another year of a sort of Graham Williams sort of thing, then maybe I'd say, yeah, that's starting to probably look tired. But because the production itself was aware of him and arguably trying to oust him, it creates an interesting colour which fits in the sense that it doesn't fit. It gives him a different ending. And I like it. And I like the sombre, quite frankly, fuck-off ending that it gets with him dying and transforming into this very fresh, quite excitable person, which probably wouldn't have seemed so fresh and excitable if he had come off Graham Williams. But then, of course, he would have never probably been cast if he had been off that point. But, possibly.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's funny. I went to see Legopolis at the BFI.
Yes, you did.
And it's beautifully tidied up, I have to say. The ending's really nice. They've all the new reshots of Jodrell Bank, the fact that you see the Doctor fall, which is lovely. It is much tighter, but the thing that jumped out, two things jumped out watching it in HD on the big screen at BFI. One, at first, it's really how desperately tatty some of the sets look. They're not, HD is not kind to them. But secondly, Tom Baker really fighting against the material, and Bidmead picked this up in the Q&A. That he gabbles through all of the sort of, and it still doesn't make sense as a script. but he gabbles through all of the exposition which Bidmead set up, which he thought was really crucial, and Tom Baker just canters through it like it doesn't matter. But the second thing is, in fighting against the material, some of his facial reactions, and the one that had the whole BFI in peals of laughter, which is more obvious on the big screen, is where he's telling Tegan that about Auntie Vanessa dying. First, there's the line, "Well, I've seen a little of her," which was fabulous. But then there's the next line where he says, "Oh yes, I'm sorry she's died, poor poor thing," and then he turns around and pulls a face.
you watch
it again now, and it's more obvious on the big screen, and he's really fighting against that material very hard, because his instincts are clearly, this isn't really what I think Doctor Who is, and it doesn't make sense, and I'm not happy with it.
But I kind of like that tension. I know exactly what you mean, especially in the early episodes, where that first episode where a lot of it is him just glumly barking and rambling to Adric. And it's, sort of, and it's sort of that "well" sort of line he sort of does, and then just fires off the exposition about entropy or chameleon circuits. And I kind of like it, because in a sense, his instincts are probably right, that while it's interesting on a third watch to see what he's specifically saying and how that is actually quite interesting, maybe if you're into sort of science and those sort of questions, and it's quite nice thematically in terms of where the audience is watching the story, it is fairly throwaway. We don't really need to know about why the chameleon circuit, you know, is doing what, and what, you know, the notions of black block transfer computations are, because, you know, essentially it's just magic.
It is magic.
It feels kind of real that perhaps a doctor would be like that, you know. It's sort of to a point where you're so intelligent that the fluffy science of it is just dull, that you don't really want to fire off all this information, because it's fucking boring. And I like that in the performance, but you're right, that comes from, by the sounds of it, a production tension, and that creates something very interesting on screen.
Oh, completely. I mean, we had a chat with Matthew afterwards, and he said about how the whole production was horrible, and Tom Baker just really was really at Grimway non-stop, row, 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 about everything, and they had a hell of a row about the final episode and everything about that build up to that final scene. He said it was quite horrible and tense and moody and grim, and I suppose the material shows that it's honest, but I have to say the fact that Bidmead thought that all this exposition was really important and Tom Baker should have given it the import and the gravitas that it needed told me everything I need to know, that Bidmead's really not the guy to be writing an action adventure serial for kids at tea time. What he'd produced was the kind of Doctor Who that you would show after an edition of Horizon on BBC Two at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday, and then maybe you'd have a scientific discussion after. So, whereas Eric, I think, gets that this is an action adventure serial, and that you've got to be moving the story, that show not tell is the way to do this. This isn't a 1950s Quatermass serial. This is an action adventure piece for the 80s. So I think Eric, to his credit, always gets that.
Well, you've talked a lot to Eric. What sort of moments or episodes or stories do you think exemplifies his skill script editor on the show?
Well, the first thing to say about Eric is completely down on his own material. He thinks all his stuff is terrible. He also thinks all the fans hate him, and that he really is not worthy to be mentioned in the same breath as Bob Holmes. I mean, that's always the sense I've had of Eric.
Very few people are.
True. That's true. But, I think if you talk to him about Earthshock, he loves Earthshock. He knows that Earthshock is his opus. He's very fond of Visitation, but he hates the production of it. Because Richard Mace was a character that he'd already had successfully on BBC Radio 4 for years. So Michael Robbins was not who he wanted to be Richard Mace. He wanted the guy who's in Emmerdale, ancient guy, Freddy he's in some Hammers in the 70s. His son was the Dream Lord. God, this is
Jones.
Like
Jones, Freddie.
Yeah,
Jones.
Freddie Jones. They wanted Freddie Jones to be to be Richard Mace. So there's all sorts of things where he goes. And after that, he said, actually, one thing he did say is he said, I always made sure that I got the director I wanted for my material after that. So that's why he gets Grim Wade. He gets Graham Harper. So he thinks very cinematically. And I think he is aware of his import in the great canon of it. But he's also very humble and always says, you know, I was against time. I didn't have budget, all those sort of things. He's an interesting blend of contradictions, is Eric. And I think that shows in his material that when he's confident and writing to his own brief in the way that he thinks the show should be done, which he does as writer, he's great. When he's having to sort of filter other people's stuff and deal with all sorts of things that are thrown at him, a little bit more difficult.
So are there any particular stories that you think other than, as you say, the Opus Earthshock, which everyone likes to talk about, which, yeah, I think is quite good. It's never been a massive favourite of mine. Not favourite, but...
Do you know what? I want to bring this up about Earthshock now, okay? For years, years, people have mocked the idea of Beryl Reed being a Starship captain.
She's fantastic. She is a Starship.
She clearly is. And, you know, even if you can't get your head around it, just look at who's leading the country at the moment. Then tell me that Beryl Reed does not make an adequate Starship captain. Maybe she'll make an adequate Starship captain, but it's entirely believable that she would be employed as a Starship captain.
June Bland would make a fantastic Theresa May. You know? If I was recasting that, I'd have, you know, you're right. It is. Yeah. And in that sense, and actually Eric does say that he loves all that aspect, you know, and we forget about Sergeant Mitchell, you know, the little 5 foot sergeant who is the tough little trooper. So in that sense, he's completely ahead of time and he hasn't got the advantage of, you know, like Cartmell was seeped in things like Halo Jones and 2000 AD. So he brought a certain neo-feminist view to his Doctor Who, which is, to his great credit, fantastic. But Eric hasn't got that. You know, Eric at that point has been a teacher. He has written for radio and he's worked on the base side of oil rigs in Holland, which incidentally is where all of the characters from Earthshock come from. So Briggs and all those hard-nosed freighter guys are all drawn from Eric's experience of working with tough, thrillingly rude, brutally frank Dutch people from the mid-70s on oil rigs. And if you think about it in that context, that's why that crew feels so real in a way that, let's say, the crew of Seabase 4 in Warriors of the Deep doesn't feel real. So those Sawardy types that they're usually described as being sort of just blunt, gruff, ruthless. I think Eric has drawn on his own experience of, well, I know he's drawn on his own experience of working in Holland in the 70s. So, you know, Lytton is almost a sort of Rutger Hauer-esque, you know, they've got a very Dutch sensibility to them, all of those characters. They're blunt, they're rude, they're, you know, they have a certain machismo to them. And I think that's a part of Eric's life that seeped into his work that we never really think about. But it's definitely there.
I'd be interested to find out whether, if he'd been writing it today, just thinking of, as in the sort of construct of today's sort of Doctor Who. So like the character of Lytton, which obviously meets his maker at the end of Attack of the Cybermen, whether that was like, would be, you know, obviously he didn't carry on much longer than that, but whether that would have been a character that would have become quite naturally sort of almost like part of the ethos, someone who could reoccur, who carries a very different, sort of very ambiguous notion to him, would be really interesting, because he's one of the very few that you get like that in Doctor who not only has a returning role, but we see sort of several sides to that role as well. And I kind of feel that could have had a little more to him. little more, had more length, more duration to that character.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I've been thinking a lot more about Lytton than anyone else in the Spiral Arm for the last 3 years, apart from probably Eric. And we've had lots of discussions about who Lytton is. And there's lots of queries that I put to him that sometimes, you know, he's still thinking about. For instance, is the Lytton we see in Resurrection of the Daleks the actual Lytton? Or is that a duplicate, a clone? Is that a different Lytton? Because he's a very different character to the Lytton that we see in Attack of the Cybermen. And, you know, we've had these discussions. So there is a conscious softening of Lytton there in between them. But there's several Lyttons, you know, because we're doing the comic. We're doing the four-part comic book of Lytton at the moment. And that's a slightly different version of Lytton in the 70s in Gangland London. And we can do this because we don't know how many Lyttons are out there. So, you know, Eric gave us a great get-out-of-jail card there with the duplicates. And, you know, I wonder what happened to the real you. But, I mean, you're right. I think they're good characters and they're well realized and they're tough and they're authentic. And, you know, Eric's revisiting Lytton yet again for the Resurrection of the Daleks novel. And I asked him, I said, has your view of Lytton changed in writing the comics and writing the book? And he said, no, not really. He said he's just a hard-nosed, skilled mercenary, soldier of fortune, with his own set of morals. He said that's him. And I think that's what we get. And I think that is a classic Sir Wardy type, is Lytton.
I think it's interesting when you think of the only other sort of what character from his era that I can think of that got brought back was Glitz, Savalon Glitz.
Yeah.
And how different he is in that sort of changeover. And again, there's a question of tone and where that positions that character, who is slightly different again, but also carrying similar notions as well, and quite dark notions to him too. But under a totally different person.
Well, of course, Lytton couldn't return, could he? Because obviously Morris Coburn died in 1989.
No, so that's true.
That's kind of in the way there. But... I'd agree largely with that, yeah.
So I think what Eric does well is I think he creates, he very much creates hard-nosed characters who live by their own terms and live in their own world. And I think this is all down to his 70s Dutch experience, where, you know, if you've been out there...
Sounds sordid now you're putting it like that.
What? Mustachio Eric, you know... I don't know. I don't want to think about that. What Eric did in the 70s, I'm sure, was completely above board and was marvellous. I suppose where it all changes, and you're probably right on this, James, is that if the Doctor is there, I suppose, to stand on the sidelines and clutch his pearls and go, that's outrageous, there should be a better way, and occasionally bring that better way into fruition, then you can have darkness and ruthlessness, you know, side by side. Like when the Doctor is willing, is sort of seemingly part of that darkness or of that amorality, then it's a lot more difficult, I suppose. And then that whole tough universe that everyone lives in, and if the Doctor is not that light in the darkness, becomes maybe a little bit more unpalatable.
It is interesting about, as you say, we get so used to these sort of conventions of different eras that we start to sort of compartmentalize. And you think, well, if I take the sort of directorial or the overall aesthetic away, how different are they from other eras? And, you know, are we sort of over considering? Because, I mean, part of me sort of says a lot of things in the Saud era, I think of, and it goes back to what you were just saying a few minutes ago, is there's a lot of sort of like survivalist feelings to it. And, you know, Turlough in particular is, you know, is a survivor, and in the core of his personality as much as in who he is in his sort of history. And there seems to be a lot of that is about, you know, survival of the fittest, or, you know, or working towards survival. But then that is a lot in Doctor Who anyway.
Turlough's a proto-Hartnellist, you know. There's nothing different between Turlough and Hartnell in the Daleks.
No, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I've always loved Turlough for that. And I think even when you get to the point of resurrection, which is, you know, one story before he Mark heads off, he is still very much a survivalist in that. He is very reluctant. He's not transformed like so many of the other characters have into heroes or into sort of positive catalysts for social change, as they, you know, telling people
how to
get out. Exactly. Yeah. All the way through. And even his final episode, which is great. I mean, Planet Fight, I find a bit dull. But what I do like about it is this real tension between him and the Doctor, because he's not playing ball in the way that companions play ball in terms
that's
of...
That's true.
And that's really interesting.
It does feel very tapped on now you mention it. Let's say, for argument's sake, Turlough stays on the space station with Stein and gets blown up in the space station. And then they kill everyone in the warehouse, and then Tegan goes, there should have been another way, and the Doctor's left on his own.
Yeah.
And then goes to pick up Perry from Lanzarote. That's much more powerful. And that's a much better ending for everyone, really. So I think it's a shame that they wanted to give each companion their own ending. I think the more modern way would be, you know, because that is the saving grace of Resurrection, which is it's incredibly violent, which I have to say I adored as a 11-year-old. Adored. But looking back, Turlough doesn't have much to do, but he does spend most of his time with the crew of the space station being whittled down, trying to save them. And if he goes out guns blazing with Stein, and then Tegan leaves because she's sick of it, and then you've got the Doctor on his own,
yeah,
that feels much more dramatically satisfying.
The sad thing is it's not even like we could say that's what would happen in contemporary Doctor Who, because as we've seen, that rarely does. He would die in that, and then three episodes later he'd reappear for some reason and then find a more suitable ending which is more palatable. But that would have been a really, especially since you've already had Adric die in that era with Tegan there, a second person on the crew dying in a similar sort of way for Tegan. You could see Tegan then just turning around with a really strong, just fuck this shit, I'm done. And that would have been really, really good. And Planet of Fire would have lacked Turlough, but then despite, I mean, the links to Turlough were never particularly fantastic. And he didn't have a great much to do in that story, even though it was about him. You can easily sort of take him out because it's largely about Perry and Perry running away from the Master.
Yeah, you don't need him at all. You really don't need him at all. I think you can do Planet of Fire completely without Turlough, and there's nothing in there for him. Even though it's his big exit story, there's really nothing there for him. I can't think of anything.
I get the impression Mark would have liked to have gone out on something more like Resurrection than Planet of Fire, like so many actors who have made a decision to leave. Having you know, a very strong, powerful end chapter is something which is far more interesting than sort of, you know, waving goodbye and going to stay with these people, which is sort of childish and lacks any finality to it. So. Yeah. Without talking to him, who knows? But I'd have thought that would have been good for the actor as well.
Gareth,
I get a feeling that Eric was never particularly rated any of Grimwade's scripts, sadly. But he always says that he felt he owed him after Earthshot, that he owed him a go and he owed him a chance. And to be fair to Eric, unlike a lot of the apart from Cartmell, where they're all new. A lot of writers get their first crack at Doctor Who under Eric. In fact, most of them are first-time writers. It's only when you get to Bob Holmes that you've got really old returning hands. I can't think of anyone up till then. I mean, Bidmead, I suppose, comes back for Frontios, but everyone else, and even Bidmead is only a couple of years earlier. There's no one with a writing credit from the 70s or before until you get to Bob Holmes, unless I'm being completely wrong here in my memory. I can't think of any.
There's only Dix for Five Doctors, isn't there? That's it.
Mm. Yeah, Terence Dix, which, you know, yeah, okay, Terry. Yeah, Terry Dicks, that's it. Because, and really, the Five Doctors is almost like a standalone. You can take it out of the run.
Yeah.
And you miss it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, apart from the rebuilding of the console room. Gareth.
But it is reintroduced in Warriors of the Gate as if... What was the Gate? Warriors of the Deep, as if it's the first time you've seen it, if I remember rightly.
Well, I, yeah, no, it's... which is probably the reason as well, as it was sort of very much a standalone event. I think it's, I still think it's interesting when you sort of say about Eric and, you know, the violence, and you're quite right in sort of saying that really this notion of the violence and this sort of oppressiveness doesn't really occur until pretty much the last season of Davison, if we're to be even kind there. And even then, it's really, really only Resurrection. Oh. Warriors, no. I can't really think of anything that Planet Fire, no. Caves of Androzani, yes, maybe. But as you say, there was that sort of tonally desire that was not him to go in that direction. Right. So why do you think, so would you sort of say you look at JNT for the sort of shift? Because there is definitely a sort of, well, no, I'm going to say definitely, but I don't know now. I'm now second guessing myself. Is there a change in Baker's era?
Yeah, there is. And I think the change is not down to JNT. I think that whole change is down to Bob Holmes. I think Eric has spent so long trying to get Bob Holmes back to the show. They've had Caves of Androzani. It's been a hit for them with the fans. And I think at that point, they're paying a great deal of attention as to what the fans think. And the fans were very important. I mean, Eric used to said that he had the office next to JNT. He said, and how it would work is that Ian Levine would come into his office and say, I've had a brilliant idea. I think we should bring back the Ice Warriors. And Eric would say, well, you know, oh, I'm not sure that fits. You know, I'll have a think about it. He said he'd then go out. He said, end of the day, Eric would be called into JNT's office an hour later. And JNT would say, Eric, I've been thinking, wouldn't it be great to bring back the Ice Warriors? He said, and I knew exactly what had happened, is that he'd gone out of my office, gone next door into JNT, and then pitched it to JNT. And if JNT liked it, it would then be repitched back to Eric. As from JNT. And I think at that point, they're paying a lot of attention. You know, it's well known that they're paying a lot of attention to what the fans think. JNT is reading all the fanzines. He's loving the adulation that he's got from cleverly bringing back this, that, and the other. But I think at that point, but the one thing that comes back that everyone goes, Jesus, that's brilliant, is bringing back Bob Holmes. So I think what season 22 becomes, that Colin Baker first one, is it really is modelled around a sort of it's harking back to that sort of really uncompromising on the nose Bob Holmes Philip Hinchcliffe era, with the added disadvantage that you've got a really Tom Baker's very amoral and I think Tom Baker's Doctor is occasionally described as being someone who is thrillingly rude to anyone who isn't Sarah Jane. And I think it is a throwback to that era, but it also has some unfortunate production elements that add on an extra layer of violence, meaningly or unmeaningly. And I know I've been talking for ages, but I'll just say one more thing. The infamous acid bath scene from Vengeance on Varos, because I've looked at this a lot, because I know Philip Martin, and it's only a problem because the acid bath scene in itself is not that much of a problem, although it's reasonably graphic. The problem comes with the quip and the comedy wah, wah, wah music. You watch it again, there's a wah, wah, wah comedy music, which is almost like, you know, sorry, I'm, you know, I won't join you. And then that music. So the delivery, the line and the music makes it look cold and James Bondish. Now, if that's delivered by Peter Davison in a more restrained, with a big frown and a big sigh, and I've tried to save you, and, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I can't join you, you know, or maybe he wouldn't have done it, or maybe he'd have said it, or maybe, you know, but that, it's the line and the comedy sting that makes that scene beyond the pale. I think without those two things, we don't even think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I rewatched the scene, I was quite surprised, because by the time I'd read all the literature, which had been going for years through Doctor Who magazine and the like, I always got the impression he sort of violently sort of grabs him and pushes him into the acid bath, and you get that sort of memory that's, you know, it augments that sort of memory of that moment, and it's nothing like that. It's nothing like that at all. I think also there is the problem, like you say, if you compare the similarities within sort of Tom Baker, Colin Baker, and obviously Colin Baker and Hartnell, which there's definitely meant to be callbacks to that sort of more abrasive Doctor. Is again, it comes down to sort of how you utilise your key actor. And Colin Baker's is a solid actor, does good stuff, but the stuff that they feed him, does that warm? Is he able to pull that off in a sort of warm sense? And as we've said before, the coat, as silly as it is a major factor. Because no one wants to, it's not a cool coat. No one wants to wear it. You wouldn't want to be seen wearing. You wouldn't want to see someone wearing it either. And there's this weird sort of construct that they create with Colin's Doctor, which just simply doesn't work. And I think Vengeance on Varos, while it is, not Vengeance, but Twin Dilemma, while it's unusual in the sense that it is pretty different to the rest in a lot of ways, it almost tries to appeal to sort of British comedy with Colin Baker, who appears as the sort of, he feels like he should be in a 70s sitcom, that he's the one who's so, it's sort of almost like a mannering, that he's so arrogant and so ridiculously over the top. And everyone can see his failings, but he can't. And that's funny. And yet somehow it's not. And from that first episode, you see there's a massive dysfunction, which they don't ever manage to find an answer to until it's too late, where he's softened down for Trial of the Time Lord, in the same way that McCoy starts off as a big mess, doesn't know what the hell he's doing with that character. No one on the production team seems to either, but they do find a route forward.
Well, I'll tell you what both of those have got in common, both of those, Time and the Rani, and what I understand about Twin Dilemma, they've got a lot more JNT input into them than the other stories around them. So JNT was, by all accounts, very focused on Planet of Fire, because it had, big guest stars in it, as far as he saw. It had prestige location filming. So he was very keen on that. And he was very, very keen on Twin Dilemma, big launch of his Doctor. Now, Kees Van der Zanne kind of does its own thing in between without him paying much attention to it. And I think it shows. And Time of the Rani is pure JNT. There's no script editor there to encumber him. And I think he has a lot of input into the Doctor's personality at that point, which I think a lot of which Cartmell ignores and throws out and goes with. I think the Twin Dilemma has a lot of JNT input in there. And I think Eric said this, that, he didn't have as much input into the new characters, the Doctor, as he would have normally had. And a lot of that was from JNT. So he was sort of stuck with it. And the main reason that era struggles as well, let's be honest, and I think Eric's been fairly frank about this, is that he wasn't particularly sold on Colin Baker as the Doctor, and he wasn't particularly sold on the aspects of the character he was working with. So that's always difficult. And I think that really shows in the material, the difficulty he's got working with that. And I think as a consequence, his interest in the other characters in the stories.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, we need to start wrapping this up in a moment, but do you think JNT genuinely saw the Sixth Doctor as a sort of Mary Sue?
I think he saw him as himself.
Yeah, I think himself.
I think it was a reflection of himself. The uncompromising attitude, the gaudy Hawaiian shirts, read for the gaudy coat, the totally tasteless, the bull in a china shop approach. All of those things that I think you could say are aspects of JNT's personality.
That's interesting, because I always saw it as just simply a method of his approach as a producer was to try and contradict as much as he could what had happened the previous Doctor. So, Peter Davison comes in, who's very pastel, not colourful, very young, very hero-focused. There's a sort of slight age to which Davison brings, but ultimately he's the sort of opposite of where Baker is. And when Davison ends, it feels like Colin is just sort of, well, how can we replicate? Well, not replicate. How can we? We'll have someone who's sort of more aggressive in his approach, a little more uncompromising, a little more like Hartnell than Troughton. Can we replicate the success of the coloured scarf with a crazy coloured suit? Maybe we can. And that's how it read to me. I've never really thought of it as I never thought of the Hawaiian shirts, especially, of it being a sort of allegory for who John Nathan Turner is.
I think it's in there because I think by the time you get to 1984, JNT has a profile that no other Doctor Who producer has ever had. You know, not only is he going to all of the conventions, and Doctor Who is enormous in 83, 84. All those big American conventions and British conventions, these are all of them. You know, he's appearing on Breakfast Time alongside the lead guy promoting the show, which I can't think of any other producer of any other show is doing at that point. So he really is becoming the show. So I don't think it's a big leap of the imagination to see that there's a lot of himself in that character of the Sixth Doctor. And we do know that he overrules, you know, Pat Godfrey and all of those costume designers. That's well known. But as he is known as this larger than life, gaudy, Hawaiian shirt wearing, unsubtle, blunt, on the nose, kind of character, I think it's impossible to untangle the two, and it explains why he hangs on to all those personality aspects of that Doctor, even when it's clear they're not working.
Interesting.
Yeah, definitely interesting. I think, gentlemen, we're due to end it there. I would suggest, however, dear listener, that you let us know what you think about the whole Sayward era of Doctor Who. And I think there's possibly some good mileage in us revisiting with maybe a commentary of one of these stories, one of Sayward's stories, in the near future. I just want to finish. Gareth mentioned Richard Mace earlier, and thanks to the BBC's Genome Project, which is a bit like Wikipedia, there's a nice listing from the 13th of August, 1976, afternoon theatre, if you were wondering what Eric Sayward was doing during the 1970s. The Nemesis Machine was broadcast at 3:05 on Radio 4, starring Geoffrey Matthews as Richard Mace, and among the guest cast, Terry Molloy.
Nice.
And Izan Churchman.
Nice.
London, 1890, Richard Mace, England's greatest actor and most astute amateur detective, comes once again into conflict with the international arch-villain, Professor Caspar Gutman. Despite the almost constant fog, Mace traces Gutman to London's literal underworld, the sewers, where their greatest and perhaps final battle takes place. Produced and directed by Roger Pine at BBC Birmingham.
Nice.
Be nice go to get a hold of listeners
to
that.
I like to think that was written on an oil rig in the North Sea.
Indeed. Let's end it there. Gareth Kavanagh and James McLean, thank you very much. That's the end of this week's podcast with a K. We'll be back with another one soon. Until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.